The Shire of Nanup would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri and Boon Wurrung people of the Noongar Nation as the traditional custodians of the land of which this podcast is recorded on, and we extend our respect to the elders past and present, and we extend that respect to all Aboriginal Australians living within the Shire of Nanup.
Well, I was coming home from Bustle in the middle of the night on my own. This animal went across the road in front of me, and I had spotlights and everything on the car, so I got a good look at it. I was surprised. Long tail, stripes, the works, and it just ignored me. It just went straight across the road. And I had to do a report of the sighting by the museum creator. Took about three quarters of an hour. And after that, he said, "I think what you seen was a thylacine." And I said, "A what?" Because I didn't know what a thylacine was. And he said, "A thylacine or a Tasmanian tiger. Your description and everything, you know, is what it would have been."
This is the Nanup Oral History Podcast. We're back talking with Jim Green, this time focusing on his connection to the bush through his forestry role, his extensive work in getting rare flora documented, and his understanding of Nanup as a biodiversity hotspot. Jim also delves into the mystery surrounding the Nanup tiger and why so many of us are convinced the forest has secrets it still hasn't shared with us. Thank you, Jim, for chatting with us.
Yeah, oh no, that's all right.
Can you tell us a bit more about your job in the forestry department?
Yeah, well, I left school early, 15, because they were starting a new flooring plant down the mill of finger-jointed flooring, which was a new thing, and tongue and groove, high-grade Jarrah flooring, the best in the world we were making. So, yeah, I learnt that and did that for 10 years. Then we had a recession and half the mill was doing two shifts, so they cut it back to one shift. And so half of us didn't have a job. So I applied for a job at the forestry. I had Christmas off, I had 2 weeks off, and started that on a 3 month trial, which lasted 42 years.
Yeah.
So that was a win. But yeah, it was bush work and pruning pines and planting trees and bit of chainsaw, then there was axe work and then chainsaw work and forest management, and that progressed all the way through over the years. And with that was the aircraft burning was a new thing, and so then we'd get into control burns, aircraft burns, and a lot of firework in the forest. So that was sort of new research. We're ahead of America, they're still learning. But over east they were trying to do burns. So here in WA, a couple of the foresters up here had been on the first aircraft burn done ever. And I learnt from them a lot of things of weather conditions and fuel and leaves and bushwork and lots of other things. Of how to do a control burn without it getting out of control, and managing the whole environment so you're not killing anything. There's patch burning, and I'm afraid some of that's getting lost these days. But and then from that there was the forest management, then the wildlife management came in with CALM department and National Park Management. Up until then, they didn't really have any resources. So our job got bigger and more interesting too. So then we had nature reserves, wildlife reserves, national parks and river and zones and road reserve zones and different things. And the whole lot was put in a plan. And so it was educational and really I found it good, because when we got into wildlife and wildflowers, and that was, I'd grown up with that, and then we were doing rare plants and animal surveys, and Nanup's still got all those things hiding around here. So the last week before I retired, I had to do go all through all the area down here in the southwest and take a ranger with me with his GPS and locate and record where the rare plants were in this whole southern area. And so that'd all be documented. And we would find rare plants and they'd have to go and find other outbreaks. And I was getting phone calls from the people in Bunbury, oh, we want you to go and find some plant that somebody found in 1890 somewhere near Nanup. So, and I said, could you give me more information, please, what it looked like? And a stunted little plant and a very small little plant, only 30 centimetres high and about 30 to 60 wide. And he said, you know, it's somewhere near Nanup. So I thought, oh, I've got a couple of ideas. So I went looking at all the hilltops around here and it wasn't there, which was the likely location. And then over towards Bridgetown, I knew on a fire break there, there was some open, prickly sort of looking, scrubby, flowery stuff. So I went and checked that out and sure enough, it was the plant and only grows in 100 metre by 100 metres in the whole world. So the boss from Bunbury was happy.
Yeah, that knowledge that you have of the bush and it's astounding.
Mm. Mm. And we did in 1988, led the Banksia Survey of Australia. So me and two of the other blokes in the gang, we said, oh, well, we'll take that on as a project. But we went round looking and for these different species and documenting from here to the south coast and found one which was hadn't been recorded before, and we got a letter back from Jan Taylor, I think her name was, who was documenting it. Great, you found that plant. There's only one halfway to Albany that's ever been found, so they were happy with that. And then we extended the range of Banksia plants further south and west of Nanup, which over 100 odd years had never been recorded. So that helped build the Banksia Atlas.
We are always told that we're in a biodiversity hotspot.
Yeah.
But you, I guess, are sharing the history of that over time by finding these species.
Well, there's a subspecies that I've been trying to get documented since about 1990, I think it was, of a Banksia, which is a little ground Banksia, and it grows from up in the ranges near Perth, down through Harvey Hills and to Luana. But then our subspecies we got down here has got a different form to it, and I sent samples up to Perth and Bunbury and Busselton, and even Jan Taylor, when she was doing the Banksias, she said it needs more research, and here we are 30 years later, still waiting for that to happen. But it's I've plotted where it all is in the south and west of Nanup, which they didn't even know it grew there. Yeah, making progress.
Yeah, that's fantastic. As part of your forestry job, you would go through and mark areas of significance to make sure that they didn't get logged.
Mm.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, well, there's under the forest logging plans by Mr. Bradshaw over Manjimup way, he drew up the Jarrah Forest interpretation of the forest and then the logging or thinning program, which was suitable, whether it was what stage of forest it is. And he did a very good document. We had to work to those rules in the later part. Before that, they selected a log, they thinned the forest, and they took a lot of the trees out, but they had to leave a seed tree in Jarrah. So you've got a seed crop for the future. So that's the old forest management, but he had it that depending on what type of forest it was or what age of it, because it's not all the same age. There's areas that are old age, others are regrowing, and then you've got regrowth, and we've got a lot of that now after the logging, but that is got to be managed different, and you do pole stand thinning in it, and so you'll have a good tree and then it's got to be thinned around it, and that good tree becomes a seed tree 100 years later. And they manage the forest on a 100-year program when they started, and it takes 200 or 300 years to become a good mill log. So it got overcut in the old days, and right up until later on, then this new program came in. And also, yeah, they have a wildlife area, which you're talking about. So there was wildlife habitat trees, and if an eagle's nest, you're not allowed anywhere near it. So we'd protect them, mark it out. So all this sort of thing was being done. And then there was the new reserves came in, and I had a little bit to put in Alice Creek up here. There's a piece of forest there at a giant jarra, and which was the biggest and the third biggest in WA, probably the world. But anyway, 60.2 cubic metre log in it, which is massive. And since then it's been hit by lightning and killed. But anyway, the other one's still there alive. But we made a reserve area there, a triangle with a creek system and this range of hill trees of old growth and old jarrah, the best you'd ever see. Beautiful, great straight trees. And black butt there as well, which is similar. Then it had to have reasons why it became a reserve. So we went out and we have found, there's things called quokkas running around there. There was little lizards. We were doing wildlife trapping, IDing plants and tree species. There's another variety of banksia there, different colour code, and I've been trying to get that documented for about 40 years. It's never been recognised as a new species or a subspecies. And it only grows through this good country here of near Nanup and the hills, and it's picky of what climate it grows in. So there was that. Anyway, this all had to be put to the Minister of WA. So me and a couple of other people that live up the Bowling Up Road, we put a submission in for the rare things like the quokkas and the plants and the trees. And first reaction was, oh, that's not right. So they had to send experts down from the city to check it out. And then the Minister of Forest at the time, he was very interested in it, and he got a copy of my submission. And he said, oh, this is great stuff, you know. So anyway, all this paperwork went through, and then they had to draw up the new calm management plans. And this minister had to sign all them, and it was the logging policy and the wildlife, the whole lot, and fire control work, everything. And this minister said to the boss of calm at the time, who I won't name, where's the submission for this Alice Creek? Or, no, I haven't got it. He said, I'm not signing anything till you put that on the table. So they had to rush around and put it into the management plans, like an afterthought, 194 hectares of prime jarrah in the Darling Range down here. And then the minister signed it, and he sent me a copy of the new paperwork, and I've still got that on file. So, yeah, it's interesting times.
Fantastic work. Well, I guess I want to talk to you next about something that you know a lot about, that is folklore maybe to some others, but obviously your time in the bush sparked a lifetime of investigation of the thylacine. Would that be correct in saying that your time in the bush sparked that?
Yeah, pretty well. Been involved a bit for the last 55 years. Really got interested.
Some people know about the Nanup tiger or the thylacine, but other people don't. So can you just give us a bit of a context?
Yeah, not a lot of detail, but I've done a couple of radio reports, and they wanted to know about it. So I went through the basic history of what had happened over the years. But when we were growing up, there were stories about the strange animals in the forest and the area of the southwest. And when we were kids, grandfathers and my uncle, they'd talked about it. And what had happened, one of my uncles, he'd been driving cattle when he was only a teenager on horseback, and he'd seen this strange animal and he chased it with his horse and it got away in the bush. And he came back to great-grandfather after he did a couple of months driving cattle. And he said, I've seen this strange animal, and it was bigger than a fox, and it was a dog type of thing. Pretty big body, long tail, and stripes. And great-grandfather said, you just described a Tasmanian tiger. And he said, well, that's what it looked like, and that's what he seen and chased. And that was back in the 1930s. So that was an early story that we'd heard of, but, you know, there was no evidence or anything. And then a man who lived next to us, part Aboriginal, and so he was driving cattle and down south of Nanup, and he reported that he'd seen one, and he had a shot at it. Now, he had a high-powered 22, and it was like one of the best guns in Nanup when I was a kid, and he was one of the best shots too. And he shot, and then when he got over in the bush and had a look around, he couldn't find the animal. So that was another story, no evidence. And other stories from the Longbottoms, who were the first people to drive cattle up to Nanup from Augusta with Higginses and another family. They brought cattle all the way up through the bush to here and Darrett up and started farming, 1862 I think it was. And they reported seeing this dog animal in the bush, and so people would just say, well, it's just a story. And that carried on. Early farmers, 1902, there was a report just out Cundinup, another family there, they'd seen this funny dog animal go across the cleared bit of their bush down there, and it was something like that, a long tail. And so there was all these. Then in 1968-69, the car rally come through here, all night car rallies we had in those days, and they'd go Busselton and Margaret River through the bush to Nanup, through here, do all this area, and then go Donnybrook and back to Bunbury. And their officials, after they'd finished their checkpoint early hours of the morning at Cundinup Road, just out of town, they had four of them in that, and they were going out through a back road, Cundinup Road, because they were like two wheel tracks through the forest. And this strange animal went across the road in front of them, and the whole four of them seen it, and they said, wow, what's that? So they got back to Bunbury and reported to the South West Times. It might have been 69 or 70 when that happened. And so we had the car club going here in Nanup at the time, and after a meeting, we were sitting around saying, oh, those rally blokes seen this strange animal. So it was about six of us in the car club meeting, and we said, oh, yeah. One bloke was a farmer, and he said, oh, that kind of up. And he said, oh, me and my wife's seen one of them go across the paddock and up over the hill, and this tiger-like animal. And then another bloke, John, who was a mill worker and a migrant to Australia, he said, oh, I was out looking for roos and rabbits out just out of town, north of town, and in the bush. And he said, I walked onto this road, and here's this wolf looking at me down the road, because he grew up in Europe. And they said, no, no, we don't have wolves in Australia, John. And he said, that's what I've seen. So anyway, we got out a cyclopedia at the car club, said, here, look at all these wild animals, pictures. So we said, see if you can see it in there. And there was tigers and lions and all sorts of things. And he's going through and he says, that's what I've seen down the bottom of this page. And we said, oh, that's a Tasmanian tiger, John. He said, that's what I've seen. I've seen one of them. And they said, oh, they're not supposed to be here. You couldn't have. And he said, yep, that's what I've seen. So he ID'd it. And I said, well, I was coming home from Busselton in the middle of the night on my own. This animal went across the road in front of me. and I had spotlights and everything on the car, so I got a good look at it. I got, I was surprised. And yeah, long tail, stripes, the works. And it just ignored me. It just went straight across the road. And so then the car club said, oh, we'll go up the museum. So me and Dave Blythe, who was president, and his wife, and my wife, and we went up to the museum. And I had to do a report of the sighting by the museum creator of planetology, which I didn't have a clue what was. And so he interviewed us and he said what I'd seen, what it did, what it looked like, everything. And he was asking me all the questions, so I'd give him the answers. Anyway, it took about 3/4 of an hour. And after that he said, I think what you seen was a thylacine. And I said, a what? And he said, a thylacine or a Tasmanian tiger. And because I didn't know what a thylacine was. And he said, your description and everything, you know, is what it would have been. And from then on, he was getting info. We were sending info of people sighting them down here. I'd interview them of what they'd seen and what it looked like and pass it on to him. And in exchange, he was telling me how all the bones in the caves down at Margaret River Augusta area were, because they were doing ID of bones in the caves. And so we were exchanging information, some of that secret, so I won't disclose it. But that's where there's the best record in Australia of prehistoric animals and Aborigines as well. It's in the Devil's Lair. And I've been down there. Yeah.
And over your time learning about thylacines, you learned a lot about them. Because I know you explained some of this to me in the past, the way they kill and things like that. Can you share some of that in terms of sightings here in Nanuk?
Yeah, well, there was all those ones north of Nanuk, 69, 70, that area. But then around 70, there was a lot at East Nanuk. And farmers going home overnight or their family. And so there was a lot of sightings and different size animals. So it wasn't just one animal, you know. And like a big old one going really slow, an old farmer reported. And then his daughter going home from the Christmas dance, and one went across the road out East Nanuk in front of her. So when she got home, she was saying, and I got to find out that she'd seen one out there and crossed the road. Most of these sightings, I'm crossing the roads 5 or 10 seconds. It's quick and they're gone, and it's very hard to photograph. So so then that's where we used the name Nanuk Tiger, because a lot of these sightings were all around here, and that's where Dave Bly said, oh, we'll call it the Nanuk Tiger. So that's where that name came from. And then when you look at location, it's around the southwest. We're right in the middle of the southwest corner. So Nanuk's a classic location for animals or wildlife. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I remember you telling me a story about the way they slice their prey or something like that. It makes it quite specific.
Yeah. Yeah, we work on a bit of that. I'd been keeping an eye on how kangaroos have been killed, and we've come across that over the years. At first we weren't sure what we were dealing with or what was going on, because nobody ever documented thylacines in Tassie properly. They hunted, shooted them and tried to wipe them all out, tried I'd say. But so yeah, we didn't know much, and they said that they'd go and chase an animal and grab it and kill it. That was about it. So we were finding kangaroos that are killed, and while I was doing forestry work or bushwork, I was always looking around at dead animals and find kangaroos that have been killed by the neck and head injuries or even more than that, and that's secret business. And their chest ripped open and only selected parts and a little bit of flesh taken. And over the years, I've found that in kills in the southwest, and nobody's ever documented that. So I still, as we're going along the road, I'll check out a kangaroo on the side of the road. People go to check if it's had a joey or whatever. And I've said to some of these other people, well, I'll check to see how it was killed. So I've been at that work for 55 years. So
I was pretty amazed to see an eagle do that to a kangaroo at our place once, take out its heart.
Yeah, that'd be, yep.
But that's the only experience I've had.
Yeah, these are the tiger's known for a clean kill. That's what I've found has been pretty well like that. And just kills them too. There's no fight. And that's unusual, but if you look at tiger's jaw and even the one we got down the statues downtown.
Do you have a lot of connection to the Indigenous people here?
My old great-granny Whittle, when she moved here in 1910, she'd been driving out in the middle of Queensland as a girl and driving wagons, and she had Aboriginal boys with her as helpers, and she was going all the way out to Mount Isa to pick up the gold and backload it back down towards the coast. And so she got friendly with the Aborigines over there. She came to Nanup in 1910, and the Aborigines were still coming up, the Biblin people were coming here to Nanup to camp still in those days. So she befriended the Aboriginal tribe people here in Nanup, and because not everybody welcomed the Aborigines coming to camp where they'd been camping for 30 or 50,000 years, new settlers. But anyway, she did, and the King Billy, they called him, but of the Biblin people, his wife was having a baby when they got here to Nanup, and she was ahead of the rest of the... They had it all planned, but she was earlier than the rest of the tribe women. And so she went up on the rocks next to our property, just on the edge of town, and because she couldn't stay with the tribe. So Granny went up there to be a midwife for her, which she'd done a bit of in Queensland, and stayed and looked after and delivered the baby. And it was one of the Nanups. And Noel Nanup, he said, oh, yeah, he knew that the baby was born here. And Noel said, there's stuff here that I didn't know about, but old Granny learnt it off the Aborigines of their sacred sites and campsites and initiation sites. And I know where all those are. So the Webbs and their family are the women's side of the tribe. And so they've been coming here for since 2000 anyway. To look at these places, and because they know the story of places, but they didn't know where they were. So I'd take them and show them.
I didn't know that there was a family of Nanups.
Yeah, the Nanup name, and some of them got sent away to Roto, and great-grandfather Whittle managed to get the eldest son off of Roto to go work and doing survey work and that, and walking. One of them, the Nanup boys, he came down the river with John Forrest, surveying down the Blackwood River, and they came to here at Nanup and camped down at Nanup Brook, and Forrest and his survey crew said, what's this? And this Nanup boy, he said, this is Nanup, the place to stop and rest. And they called it Nanup Brook, and still is today. And that's the first permanent fresh water in the Blackwood River. All further up the river is getting more drier and drought affected. So Nanup's in a lucky place there with fresh water. And like the water tree halfway to the south coast, the Miliani tree, which is dying now, but that was a site where Millie Annie got speared in the thigh because she ran away from the elder. And there's a legend story about that. And Mr. Webb married one of those girls, and they were about third generation after Miliani. It's in their Aboriginal stories, but it's like a bloodline, see? So the women line and the girl out at Jarrowood, she's still a granddaughter of that family. Also, by coincidence, the Queen, when she came out in 2000, she had the Webbs sit next to her at the table dinner in Busselton to recognise the Aborigines. And there's another story to that, why the royal family know about the Aborigines down here. And the Queen was very supportive. And maybe that'll continue with other generations.
Obviously, someone that spent a lot of time in the forest your whole life, what would you say the state of the forest is in now?
It's a mixed bag, is the best way to put it. You've got reserves and national parks. Like I said, we joined areas down south, and there's one piece down there, Miliani, after Miliani, the girl, is named. That is Virgin Jarrow Forest. It's been saved by the Forest Department and all the parks afterwards. It is Virgin Jarrow Forest in its natural state of evolution. You can see, if you, I'll take you and show you, giant jarrows that fall down when they're 500 or 1,000 year old, and then regrowth of jarrow seedlings replacing that, and it's an only natural jarrow forest in its natural form, still standing. And then there's areas of it which is in the next stage of, you know, you have regrowth and then you have mature growth, which they call old growth. And there's jarrow trees in there like gun barrels straight, 100 feet high, and just massive, beautiful select jarrow trees. And then under that is the natural vegetation. And so where there's big trees and that, there's not much regrowth or undergrowth or smaller varieties of trees. So you can walk through it and you can see it like it over 500 years it would be changing. And no, but we've been down and done a couple of surveys in it, and nobody's really documented it properly. We were going in there to measure the growth rates of trees because an old growth forest is growing slower, where a new forest grows quicker, you know, because young things grow up quick and they mature. So that's how the forest grows. But that's the best example in the whole world of jarrow forest. And my secret tree in there, yeah, the biggest circumference jarrow tree in the world. And I used to have to go and protect it from where we were going to do burns. And it's been protected 2 years ago by the local workers. It is about 14 metres circumference, a metre above the ground. It's a giant Aboriginal camp tree, so the whole family could camp in it because it's a big hollow. And it's right on a Biblum trail by coincidence. And yeah, so that is, I've got photos of it, and yeah, it's really something out of the ordinary.
I know that a few other people have been talking about drought and climate change and things like that. So I did want to hear it from your perspective, because obviously, you know, last summer didn't rain for about 8 months or something from memory.
Yeah, well, I've been here quite a few years now. About 1970, I noticed we were having long, hot summers because I was out looking for tiger tracks at the time, and I was going around all the dams, which were all drying up, hoping to find footprints. But anyway, I noticed that, yeah, there was lack of water, and that's progressed since then, that overall, since 1970, we've had declining rainfall and hotter days. Like last year, not this summer, but the summer before, we had the most 40-degree temperatures ever, and then we were right up to it again this year. And so this is the second hottest that there's ever been recorded, and last time was the hottest. So the heating trend is definitely here, and even you hear of them saying, oh, well, maybe there is a thing called climate change, but, yeah, I've researched it, but that'll take too long. But, yeah, we're in a dry period. And then we started up a thing called reforestation, and I was involved with that with the forest manager at the time, or lands department, and forest and national parks, and an ex-forester type person, and looking at what to do. So I said, well, look, we got these giant blue gums that grow in the arboretum in Nanup, and they grow quick, and they grow a crop of timber that you can use as chip, or as they're older, you can use it as a hardwood. So they started looking at what to do further east and in the southwest of degraded farmland, and to move the forest area out bigger. And so we were planting trees from here and going further inland up to Boyart Brook and halfway to Arthur River, and planting blue gums. And now they are tree farms, mm-hmm. and that's one of the biggest crop dollar mm-hmm. values in WA for export, which meant you didn't have to go and chop down all the state forest. So out of that, we went from 0.9 of 1% of the land of WA was forest that had got down to that. And then with this rehab and replanting, it went up to 1.1% of the state is now forest, or tree farm included. So that was a move in the right direction. And also, if you've got trees in a like our southwest climate, you actually protect this drought type of effect. It keeps the temperature down a little bit, and so you don't get the sort of drought flood effect, which is happening right across Australia now. You end up with a more stable climate, and so far our water in the Yarragadee is still clean. And so that sort of thing, and some of our brooks and rivers, we replanted valleys. So instead of having muddy water, you've got clean water again. So there's not enough of that work being done, I'm afraid. We've done things in the town to keep it progressing, and I've been involved in a lot of clubs. Like, we had the big floods, so some of them are documented, some are not. But the Blackwood River flooded, and it was really high in Nanup. And the early settlers said where, you know, it was a really big flood. And that's about all. Then when Granny got here in 1910, they had a bad winter again. Rained all of July. And by early August, the water was right up and on the floor of the town pub. Now, I've given the surveyors and Nanup and that all these figures of the 1910 flood. And we did have the marker up the big tree, and then they said, oh, the water authority's got no record of that. But the oldest people of the town did have. And that was up in the pub again.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had a 53, February, late February, about 23rd, when I was a kid. There was a summer flood, and we were having reports. It was 100 degrees, dry, no rain. And they said, oh, the river's flooding, it's coming down. And all the old people and Dad and Sam Duller, they said, oh, well, it's hot weather. There won't be much water get down the river to us. Anyway, there was more water than they thought. And it just kept coming up all day from being almost the river empty. And the river just kept coming up all day, and it was flooding all the bottom of the town, and got right up to the bowling green and into some houses. And there was the first summer flood ever recorded. So before that, there's never been a flash flood of that ever happening here. So that's to do with land clearing or climate change or both together, who knows. Then if 53 was that flood, 54 we had a winter flood and it was over the road. We had to walk on the rails to get across the dry brook to school. But 64, then we had a winter flood and it rained and rained a lot. And that got up to the war memorial. And that's not documented very well. And I've got photos of old houses downtown with it right up on the roof. So that was a winter one. Then later in the 60s, we had quite a lot of rain. So it was like a wet period. And then, like I said, 70, it dried out, got hotter, until 82, when the big storm went down through the wheat belt again. We didn't get any rain. And I was telling the people downtown, Dad tried to tell them, you're going to have to get out. And they were new people in town. And they said, can't be a flood because it's hot weather. And so I had to take them photos of the flood before. And I said, last time they had, I think, 6 or 8 inches of rain out Wagen in that area. And I showed their house they were in and it was up on the gutter on the roof. And I said, this time they've had 8 and 10 inches, so I don't think there's going to be much of your roof sticking out of the water. So I said, start packing. So they did. And then they had to move up the hill the next morning and the river's coming up their yard towards ours. So, and then we had to evacuate the town and move everything out. And I spent all day moving parts and stuff out of the garage down by the rail, by the bridge and Rose Garage. And it was all spare parts and everything, so it was a big job. And then we decided that NANOP needed some probably assistance or something in that line. So the Shire President, Bill Dean of the day, he said, well, we need a Lions Club. They're the best of worldwide and to help be a volunteer group and for when you're needed to do things. So that's how our Lions Club started up.
The Lions Club started after the flood of 1982.
Yeah. Oh. 82, end of 82, we drew up the Lions to get formulated. And the 7th of January 83, we chartered the club. And I'm a charter member, one of the last still standing. And so now 42 years later and a bit, we're still going. And it's community work and helping where you're needed. So that's helped our town.
Yes, helped our town a lot.
And the bowling club, would you believe? Bit of research there, but Greens is the name, Bowling Green. And grandfather and his brother, the Green boys that came here, they grew up around the castle in England and mowing the Royal Green was one of their spare time jobs. But I've stumbled on great inventions of the world and Greens got an order to invent and make the first commercial lawn mowing lawnmower and with an engine. And they designed and built it and then it's got on the order I found out of this great inventions a seal ordered by the King of England. And I've got that down the bowling club on the wall. So that was a chain reaction there. So grandfather and then when after World War One was finished and great aunt, she was Progress Association and country women and everything, Ganana, she said, well, we'll start a bowling green and a croquet green. So they made it a return soldiers project. They started levelling the ground and I've still got the paperwork and Bishops helped with the finance to buy a bit of timber and corrugated iron to make a roof. And they had a first clubhouse, sports club room downtown there, still standing. 1919 and 2021, that was all done and made the bowling green and it's an ANZACS project, so it's got a bit of history to it, and it's not recognised very much in the town, but grandfather was involved in it and being an ANZAC. So that's how that got here, and it's built on a British village green setting. Yeah, so there's a bit of history behind it that's not recorded, but it is now.
Yeah, I had no idea that there was that history. And you're very heavily involved in the bowling club.
Yeah, vice president and player, 30-odd years. We're the first bowling club in WA, probably Australia, to have women can play in the pennants team, men's pennants team. Because we've got an allowance, because of lack of number of people, we can have one woman per four team, and we have two teams of four. And so quite often we have a woman in each team playing to make up our numbers. And then we've done that for the last 3 years or so, and the Lewin League endorsed that. But now the Lewin League's made it, anywhere in the Lewin League, ladies can play in the pennant side. And so that's the first in WA. And now Perth and WA Bowls Association is looking at it as being acceptable. There'll still be men's singles and women's singles comps, but this is just to keep people playing bowls mainly. Friday nights and social, and that keeps people involved in the learning bowls and keep the game going.
Also, the Nanup Music Festival, each year you have a lot of activities there.
Yeah.
And a lot of people learning bowls then, really, or you hire out the bowls?
Yeah, they come and have a go at bowls and give them a few pointers, and it's surprising, with a bit of practice, and they say, wow, we can do this. So, yeah, the tourists enjoy having a bit of fun. Well, they're looking at making it a sideline for this pushbike event too now, because there'll be pushbikers here for the World Championships, and they'll be here for a week or so.
Jim, thanks so much for coming to talk to us, for sharing some of your expertise and some of your experiences, both pre-Nanup with your family and here. Mm. Thank you so much.
Yeah, oh no, that's all right, because a lot of this has got to be documented or I'll be the last man standing.
You've been listening to the Nanup Oral History Podcast. If you are not a Nanupian, please come and visit our small town. We would love you to come. If you are a Nanupian, please share it with your family and friends. We're really proud of this, and we hope you are too.
This podcast was made possible through the successful funding by the Department of Community's Age Friendly Community Program, facilitated through the local government's professionals and supported by the Shire of Nanup. We would like to thank all of those who have shared their stories to make this podcast happen. The podcast has been produced by the Shire of Nanup's Economic and Community Development Team and edited by Simple Ben Stories.